Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmin Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering. Today, we start in Cohasset. But beforehand, just a quick warning to our listeners. The content of today's conversation might be difficult for some listeners. It includes references to murder and domestic violence. The case of Anna Walsh has dominated headlines for the last 3 weeks. So let's get you caught up.
The search for the Cohasset mother of three remains close to where she was last seen early New Year's Day. The 39-year-old has been missing for almost a week.
Anna was reported missing by her employer on January 4th. 4 days later, her husband was arrested.
The 46-year-old husband of Anna Walsh was brought into custody by police. He's charged with misleading a police investigation.
Police continued their investigation.
This morning, it appears that investigators have concluded their search of the property of Brian and Anna Walsh. There is still no sign of the missing mother of three. Her husband remains behind bars.
And this week, there was a new development.
Her husband, Brian Walsh, is charged with her murder.
All that sound is from WCVB. We do want to note to our listeners that Brian Walsh has been charged with murder, not convicted. We are going to discuss domestic violence and intimate partner homicide a little later in the segment, but we want to start today's conversation with some of the legal questions surrounding this case. So we have Michelle Cruz here with us. She is a Massachusetts-based attorney with more than 20 years of litigation experience in civil rights, criminal law, and victims' rights and family law. Thank you so much, Michelle, for being with us.
Thank you, Yasmin, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this very disturbing case.
Yeah, and disturbing indeed. This story has had a lot of twists and turns. And I want to know if you were surprised that Anna Walsh's husband was charged with her murder.
I can't say I was surprised. I was definitely relieved that they acted quickly and pretty impressed with the level of investigation that has taken place so far.
And again, I'm going to keep repeating this. He is charged and not convicted. So all of this is alleged murder. So as of this morning, Anna's body has not been found. Is it common for a murder charge to be given if there's no body?
So I would say that it's not common, but it has occurred before. And it makes obviously for a difficult case. But there's pretty, from what I've seen so far and based on the information available, seems like there's a pretty strong circumstantial case here with a lot of physical evidence pointing in one direction.
And I want to put a pin in that because I'm going to ask more questions about that later. But while there is no body, Norfolk prosecutor Lynn Beelin presented some Google searches allegedly made by Brian Walsh during his arraignment this week. I want to again highlight to some listeners that the sound here might be disturbing.
At 4:55 a.m. on January 1st, he searched how long before a body starts to smell. At 4:58 a.m., how to stop a body from decomposing. At 5:20 a.m., he searched how to embalm a body.
That sound is from WCVB. So can a Google search be submitted as evidence?
With regards to Google searches, you can enter that into evidence. It's not for the truth of the matter asserted because that's hearsay, obviously, but it's to show information that was requested off of Google. And the content and the search obviously are concerning facts that that the prosecutor has uncovered. They're going to have a little bit of a difficult time with authentication, how to show that it came from, you know, that particular device. There's going to probably have to be search warrants to the search engines and IP information. So it's a technical case, but it can be brought into court.
I'm curious if there are other pieces of evidence that you're thinking about and looking at that go beyond the Google searches or the missing body.
So I think with this case, the information that I've seen that's available to the public, and as you know, with the this investigation doesn't stop once there's an arrest, it continues. But the information available so far to the public includes information such as the defendant gave certain statements about his whereabouts when questioned by the police. And kind of overlaying that is also he requested windows because he was on house arrest, if you recall, to go to certain events like dropping off the kids or going to his mother's house. But it turns out that some of that information wasn't accurate. My understanding is the kids actually didn't have school on January 2nd. So he wasn't dropping them off. And, you know, that's concerning information. But he gave a timeline of where he was and the things he was doing. One of those timelines includes he went to his mother's house, then he went to Home Depot, Whole Foods, and then CVS, when in fact, he was later seen on video, or what they believed to be him on video, at Home Depot buying certain items, including, he was buying, I believe,
$450 worth of cleaning supplies.
Correct. And some of the places he said he was, he actually was confirmed not to be there, but to be in other venues. And so that storyline is going to be a huge part of this circumstantial case. The other pieces are the DNA. My understanding is they looked through a trash pile in Peabody, and they found a rug. They found a Cybex suit, a hacksaw, and other items. And then they were able to uncover some DNA on at least the Tyvek suit the rug, I believe, that matched both Anna and the defendant. So that information is hard to kind of maneuver around because there was an absolutely different timeline presented to the police when initially questioned. And those pieces of hard DNA are really going to be difficult for the defendant to contend with. There's definitely some very interesting pieces of evidence. I believe there's also a bloody slipper found that had her DNA and his DNA on it.
Do you think more charges could be filed against Brian Walsh?
There could be more charges. I think that the charges presently are based on just what I'm seeing, appropriate based on the circumstances. When you look back at the history of these parties, there was a threatening call back in, I think it was 2014, where Anna had called the police about her, at the time, boyfriend that the D.C. Law enforcement has confirmed was, I believe, Mr. Walsh. And there was also, I understand, some fight over where the children were going to live, as Anna, I believe, was living part-time in D.C. because of her work.
Yeah.
And Mr. Walsh was on house arrest up here in Massachusetts. So it sounds like there was a lot of tension. And, you know, I don't know the entire history, but it sounds like, with that one call to the police in 2014, that there's some domestic violence present in this case. And probably, as we learn more from Anna's, circle, that I think we're going to learn more about the inside of that home and
what
was
going on. It's no doubt such a huge part of this conversation. But thank you so much, Michelle Cruz. And that's Massachusetts-based attorney Michelle Cruz, and she has more than 20 years of litigation experience in civil rights. Thank you for joining us, Michelle. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, this case has dominated headlines in the Commonwealth, throughout the nation. And I want to shift now to talk about how this case is being portrayed. So I'm bringing in Northeastern University Assistant Teaching Professor in the program in Media and Screen Studies, Laurel Onert. And so, Laurel, it's so nice to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You heard what Michelle and I were talking about, just outlining the story. What has struck you the most as you watched the story unfold in the media?
Well, I think what's most notable here in cases like this is that it's real-time coverage of an ongoing event as it unfolds in time. You know, there's a lot more facts to come, I'm sure, as the investigation continues. And so what we see is two parallel tracks emerging, right? The arraignment has happened. We imagine that there might be a trial coming. That we have the court case and then the court of public opinion emerging. These two parallel tracks that are connected as media covers these events as they're investigated. But with the court case, the outcome is about justice. It involves an adversarial system where a prosecutor lays out the facts and a defense attorney makes a rebuttal. But that same kind of adversarial system doesn't happen in media coverage. Media coverage is about telling a story to inform, to entertain. And so there is a different set of norms and outcomes. And so I think that's important to keep in mind, not to, you know, defend Brian Walsh in this case or anything, but to just encourage us to be savvy media consumers and understand
the distinction. Because we don't know if he did it. Like, he hasn't been convicted again. But, I mean, just a really basic question. Do you think the media is doing a good job?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. I think that the media could potentially be informed by some of the trend in true crime podcasts, like My Favorite Murder and other types of podcasts that take a very particular feminist approach to coverage, where they center the voices of women, they give victims and survivors space to tell their own stories, and pay attention to the life and achievements of the victim as opposed to the gruesome details and circumstances of their death.
So just why do you think these cases capture, why do you think Anna Walsh's case has captured attention?
I think we tend to pay more attention to victims with socially desirable attributes. They tend to be young and attractive women, people who are more middle class or affluent, who are seen as the ideal sympathetic victim. And that's not to take away from the tragedy of what we imagine happened to Anna, but to acknowledge that those who deviate from these ideal norms are often denied recognition as victims. They're not seen as deserving of public attention and protection. The Black and Missing Foundation did research, and they found that 40% of missing persons cases involve people of color, but only 13% of those cases are covered in media.
And I know there have been more efforts to draw attention to that coverage, but it's still not nearly enough, we're seeing, obviously. So thank you so much. We've been speaking with Laurel Onert, a Northeastern University assistant teaching professor in the program in Media and Screen Studies. Stick with us right now. We still have a lot of legal questions and ethical questions coming up in this case, but I want to shift. Because this week, Brian Walsh, Anna's husband, was formally charged with her murder. And so we want to note that the investigation is still ongoing. He has not been convicted. But an important part of this conversation in a case like this is domestic violence homicide. These incidents are not uncommon in Massachusetts. According to a recent report from the State Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, there were 15 domestic violence homicide victims in 2021. In the studio with us also is Sue Chandler, executive director of Dove. She's here with us. And her organization in Norfolk County, it's a nonprofit that's provided services for survivors of domestic violence since 1978. Sue, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Yasmin and WBOR, for covering this very important story.
And so tell me first, like, what is striking to you about this case?
I think I would echo what Laurel just commented on about the disparities in the way some of these cases are covered based on who the victim is in the story. What's striking is maybe some of the commonalities in what we know in these situations is when people, neighbors, friends say, but he was charming. He was great. We knew him. This is stunning. That is very common to hear.
The initial pearl clutching of, like, how could he ever do this?
Yes.
And so could you tell me about some of the signs, some of the red flags that indicate someone may be suffering from domestic violence, and maybe focus on some signs that people aren't as quick to pick up on?
Yeah. I think there's a couple different angles on this. One is thinking about what might be happening for somebody in a situation. They may have some sort of gut feelings or spidey sense that something is off, but that sort of justify it or make excuses. But we encourage folks to listen to that. Sometimes at the beginning of a relationship, somebody might be just so incredibly attentive, again, charming, doing favors for somebody, and a feeling of, wow, this is just too good to be true. That might be happening. Where they're saying, I would love to know where you're going to be, who you're going to be with, because I'm worried about you. I just want to make sure for your safety. So paying attention to those things. And then, as I said, there may or may not be a gut feeling that something is normal or off. And for friends and family, thinking about what are you noticing? Isolation is incredibly common, a strategy of people who use abuse to isolate the victim from friends, family, coworkers. And so, you know, things like, I just want to have you all to myself this weekend. Can we not go watch the game at your sister's house? Or do we have to do this? Let's just hang together. That kind of stuff.
It sounds caring, but it's really it's isolating you and making you easier maybe to manipulate. But you know, we do want to mention domestic violence happens across genders and social classes, and I do want to ask you that if I suspect someone is struggling with domestic violence, it's a hairy situation for a bystander, a friend. Where do you even begin in calling that out? And should you always call it out? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really, really important. I think it depending on if it's somebody if you know well or maybe less well, like a neighbor or a coworker, we would encourage folks to become knowledgeable themselves. And first and foremost, to do some self-care. Figure out how are you going to manage your own anxiety about this. It's very important to stay connected to the person and not do anything that's going to increase the isolation. So you might very gently, you know, first, a lot of people don't identify with the term domestic violence, the label domestic violence. So don't necessarily approach with that right up front, but maybe saying something like, you know, I've noticed this. I'm a little concerned. How are you feeling about it? We'd really love to see you. I understand you maybe want to stay home for the weekend, but we hope that maybe could we make a plan during the week? Can we walk the dogs together? Can we talk on whatever day? Don't trash talk the person using the abusive behaviors, because that's just going to cause the victim to become defensive, and all the attention and energy goes there. Help them stay sort of grounded and normalize their life. Maybe inquiring, not blaming, but things like, how do you think this might be impacting the children? I really care about you. I'm concerned. I would really love to be a resource and help. If you'd like to use my computer, use my phone, for somebody maybe who's you're less connected to, giving them a safe link, little business card or a phone, you know, scrap of paper with a phone number and the safe link state hotline on it to say, this may or may not be happening for you, but in case it is.
And that phone number is 877-785-2020. We'll include it on our website, wbur.org. And I also want to mention another resource, Sue, while you're here, the 10 to 10 helpline, anonymous, free, confidential. And that serves Massachusetts adults and teens, 877-898-3411.
And that is a helpline for people who may recognize in themselves that they are using behaviors that we would consider coercive, abusive, that are problematic. It's a place now called a call to change helpline, but to reach out and use somebody as a sounding board to think about how you can stop using these behaviors.
We've been speaking with Sue Chandler, the executive director of Dove, a Norfolk County-based nonprofit that has provided services for survivors of domestic violence since 1978.